This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest today is Peter Godfrey Smith, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and a professor of the History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Sydney. Peter is the author of four books, including Theory and Reality, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science, and Darwinian Populations and Natural Selection. His underwater videos of octopuses have been featured in National Geographic and New Scientist. Peter Godfrey Smith is here to tell us about his most recent book, Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness, published in 2016. Welcome, Peter.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What led you to write Other Minds? What is your purpose?
It came out of a particular couple of experiences. So I've always worked in the philosophy of biology and also the philosophy of mind. So those have been my two main areas. And I hadn't thought that much about particular non-human animals, although I guess I should always have been doing that more. And then over a period of time, close to 10 years ago now, I began to spend just some spare time swimming around in the water in Australia more than I had been before. And I began to notice these particular animals, cephalopods. Firstly, giant cuttlefish, and then octopuses. And first I was just stunned at the animals themselves. I mean, they're so spectacular, especially the cuttlefish, and so weird, especially the octopuses. And then began reading a little and thinking, and I realized that they were important animals, not just interesting animals, but important animals for trying to understand the evolution of nervous systems, behavior, the evolution of the mind. So the book came out of that.
As a scuba diver, you have had the chance to observe the octopus living in its natural habitat. What is life like for an octopus?
Well, it depends on the octopus. I should emphasize that the ones I write about in the book are a particular species for the most part. So there's an Australian species I know fairly well. That's one of 300 species, and the things I'll say about the Australian ones need not apply to all the others. But the ones I study and observe a lot, the common name for these animals is the gloomy octopus, which is quite a charming name, I think. They are fairly solitary animals, except for a very important exception that I write about in the book, one particular place where you see large numbers of them. Octopuses are carnivorous animals. They hunt a lot. They build dens, hunt. They have rather non-intimate sex lives, I would have to say. It's not a very exciting, romantic life being an octopus, especially because it's thought that it could be somewhat dangerous for the males. The females, in at least some cases, are inclined towards sexual cannibalism. So it's a life with a lot of dangers, both from other animals around and from your own kind, but a complicated exploratory sort of life. One of the things I find interesting about octopuses is they are, I think, you know, because they are exploratory sorts of animals with respect to their hunting, they're very interested in novelty. They like new things. They are intrigued by objects that divers might bring down and present to them, or even ones that we don't present to them that they just take a liking to. So a complicated life with a lot of roaming around and exploring, a lot of hunting, and also a very short life. It's one of the surprises here. Most octopuses are dead within 1 or 2 years. The whole life comes and goes very quickly.
I think most people have a sense of what an octopus looks like, but would you go into a bit of detail about the body of an octopus?
Okay, the eight arms of a starting point. It's important to think of those arms as arrayed around the mouth. So you could really, in some ways, think of them as eight very large and dexterous lips. So there is a recognizable head with two eyes, and the central brain is there between the two eyes. Then there's a sort of large sac-like body area called the mantle. And that's where you find, you know, the usual sorts of organs you'd expect to find in a body. Octopuses have three hearts rather than one heart. So they are built on quite a different design. And beyond those generalizations, I think the big fact about octopus bodies is they have no fixed shape at all. They can put their body into pretty much any shape they want. They can crawl through a space not much bigger than their eyeball. They really have bodies of almost unlimited possibility.
What qualities does the octopus possess that suggest a higher consciousness?
Well, higher consciousness, that's not a phrase I would use. But I'd use two phrases that are in the ballpark. So I think, firstly, they have some cognitive ability, which could reasonably be called sophisticated cognitive ability. They don't just operate on reflexes and instincts and things like that. They can learn in rich ways about the world. They can learn new food sources. They can learn to solve problems. They can learn to recognize individual humans, which is a very surprising fact. For an invertebrate animal that has no particular business tracking the identities of individual humans, it's surprising that they nonetheless can. So things like that show a kind of sophistication on what you might call the cognitive side, the sort of information processing side. And partly because of those things, and partly for sort of related sorts of reasons, I think it's probably right to say that for octopuses, there is such a thing as subjective experience. There's something it feels like to be an octopus in a way that I don't think is inevitable for all living things or probably even all animals. Now, what exactly it takes to be an animal with the capacity for subjective experience, I can't give a very definite answer to a question like that. And part of the point of the book is to explore the question, try to make a bit of progress on it. But that, I think, is a good way of marking out a big fact about at least some animals. So it's true of us. And the question is which other animals it's true of. I would think that octopuses are also in there. Now, the phrase you used, consciousness, people often do use that phrase very broadly to refer to any kind of subjective experience. And to some extent, the subtitle of the book suggests that. Myself, though, I think that it is better to think of consciousness as something a little bit more specific, a little bit more sophisticated. So I think the right shape that a good theory will eventually have in this area will be one in which there's a broad category, animals that can have subjective experience. And within that, a subcategory of animals that have something richer, which is fairly referred to as consciousness. Now, if you ask, okay, so what would be a kind of subjective experience that did not count as consciousness? I think that something like pain might be a reasonable example. So I think, if you ask, do squid feel pain or do bees feel pain? To me, at least, that's not the same question as the question, is a squid conscious or is a bee conscious? I think of pain as a kind of a form of genuine feeling, a kind of genuine subjective experience, but one which is reasonably regarded as distinct from consciousness.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Peter Godfrey Smith, author of the book Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. How does the brain and nervous system of an octopus compare to our own? How are they the same and different?
Well, the big similarity is the fact that nervous systems are built out of neurons, nerve cells, not just out of those cells, but those are a very conspicuous and important ingredient in a nervous system. And it's probably true that neurons just evolved once in the history of animal life. That's not completely clear. They may have evolved more than once. But our nervous systems are the product of the same evolutionary origin for the neuron that the octopus is. And there's a fair bit of similarity with respect to those cells that are the building blocks. But then once you build a system, a nervous system out of those cells, in many cases you wind up with very different things across different animals. And the big difference between us and octopuses is a matter of centralization. So in our case, most of the neurons in our body are in our skulls, in our brains. You do have some elsewhere, but we're somewhat centralized sorts of beings with respect to how the controllers of our body are organized. In the case of an octopus, on the other hand, more than half of the neurons, something like two-thirds of the neurons in the animal, are not in the head, the sort of central brain, at all. They're spread through the rest of the body, especially in the upper arms, the arms and the upper arms in particular. So you should think of an octopus as having a much more decentralized organization as compared with us. You know, with us, you've got the kind of the CEO, the brain that's in there, and the rest of the body being told what to do, essentially. In an octopus, to at least some extent, the body is its own controller. There are nerve cells all through the parts of the body that are also the parts that do things.
What are the implications of having these somewhat different nervous systems and brains?
That's still being studied. It's hard to know. I think this is one of the most fascinating questions in the area. There's a laboratory in Jerusalem, Benny Hochner's laboratory at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, which studies this particular question very closely. And one thing they want to understand is to what extent the octopus can exert a kind of top-down control over its arms, as opposed to a situation where the arms, you know, roughly speaking, make their own decisions over what to do. And the general tenor of the results coming out of that lab, one experiment in particular, is one that suggests that octopuses can exert real top-down control when they want to. There was a nice experiment they did. The first author on this paper was not Hochner, but Tamar Gutnik, so it's a long list of authors. The octopus had to get its arm to a particular destination by reaching it down a very specific path that included going out of the water. So the arm couldn't follow some chemical path. It had to be guided specifically by the eyes. And the question they asked was, you know, can an octopus learn to direct its arm with that kind of specificity? And, you know, they could, roughly speaking. It wasn't an easy task, but they were able to do it. So on the sort of behavior control side, the big question is, you know, to what extent do you have partial autonomy in the arms as determinants of their own motions, as opposed to the more familiar case where there's a single controlling center that works out what to do? And it might be fair to summarize the picture that's emerging as one in which there's a sort of a mixture of both. There's some degree of autonomy, but also real top-down control. Now, on the more philosophical side, the idea of this decentralized nervous system raises all sorts of questions about the existence of a centralized self, you know, whether there's a kind of a center of experience with the kind of unity that in the human case, we certainly seem at least to have, you know, a sort of single, this I, you know, the subject of experience with a, what feels at least like a reasonably definite, definitely unified nature. Now, that might be an illusion in our case. Plenty of people have thought that we tend to impute more unity to our own experience than is really there. But however much we have, there's a possibility that an octopus has a lot less.
What is the evolutionary relation of humans to octopuses?
Well, the big fact is that we're far away in evolutionary terms. So if you think about the history of all life on Earth, but especially animal life, especially animals in particular, and the shape of that history, it's fair to think of it as a kind of tree-shaped, where for any two species alive now at the present time, if you trace the paths backwards through time, you get to a common ancestor eventually, something that was the ancestor of both of those things. So, you know, we have a common ancestor with chimps that lived something like 6 million years ago. The common ancestor we have with octopuses lived something like 600 million years ago, which it sounds like a long time. And in a way, there's a sense in which it's even longer than it sounds, because life was so different 600 million years ago. This is before the Cambrian explosion, the evolutionary period that produced the familiar kinds of the forms of animal life that we're mostly familiar with. You know, it's quite a mysterious time. No one really knows what was going on 600 odd million years ago. But most likely, the common ancestor, or rather the last, the most recent common ancestor of us and octopuses lived then. It was probably a very simple animal. If you picture a kind of maybe a flattened worm, perhaps something less than a centimeter long, I mean, that would not be a bad thing to picture, that no one really knows. And some of the important evolutionary facts here involve the way that from that simple beginning, from that simple animal form, the common ancestor of all the vertebrates and not all the invertebrates, but a great range of invertebrates, octopuses, ants, earthworms, bees, starfish. That little animal that was a common ancestor of all those was a sort of simple thing from which great diversity came through successive splitting or branching events in evolution. And with respect to invertebrate animals, most of what you got arising was animals that had relatively simple nervous systems. But with octopuses, you get a very big nervous system. With cephalopods in general, but octopuses certainly, a very big nervous system. So they're a kind of independent experiment. It's a rare, separate experiment in the evolution of a large nervous system outside the vertebrate line.
What was the nervous system of our common ancestor like, the worm that you described?
Well, no one knows. I would love to know. I mean, I think all you can say with confidence is that there was a nervous system there. It may have been spread through the body in a kind of a nerve net form without much centralization in the front end, ahead. But there may alternatively have been some centralization. There may have been a very small brain there as well as the nervous system elsewhere in the body. It's thought fairly likely that this animal had very simple eyes, although that's somewhat conjectural. But genetic evidence suggests that at least sort of simple eye spots on each side of the head that have light sensitivity may well have been present. Beyond that, it's hard to say anything with any confidence.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Peter Godfrey-Smith, author of the book Other Minds, The Octopus, The Sea, and The Deep Origins of Consciousness. Would you say more about how the nervous system and mind of the octopus evolved from our common ancestor?
All of these questions are questions about the sort of deep history of animal life, where it's easy to offer conjectures, but it's very hard to offer anything very firm. And my background is philosophy. I've come to this to some extent from the outside. So I'm an avid reader about the deep history of animal life, but by no means an expert. I can sketch a bit about some parts of the likely pathway between that common ancestor and the octopus. The common ancestor was not itself a mollusk. It was something that was the ancestor of all the mollusks, also eventually of all the insects and all the crabs and all the starfish, lots of things. So you think of it as very nonspecific. At some point during the Cambrian, or perhaps even a shade before, the mollusk body plan evolved. Now, mollusks, which include things like oysters and clams and snails, as those three cases illustrate, one of their specialties is evolving a shell, a hard external protective shell. And that has the effect usually of making them not very mobile, reducing their behavioral possibilities, but affording them also a lot of protection from predators. So rather than animals that right from the get-go were evolving a sort of rapid, lively style of interaction, the mollusks were to some extent specializing in taking things a little easier and relying on their shells. And it was just one relatively small group of mollusks who abandoned that way of life. Early cephalopods still had shells, and some of them became very big. So there was a period closer to the origin than to the halfway point between that common ancestor at 600 million years or so and close to the present, where cephalopods were probably the largest and most ferocious predators in the sea. There were some that were very long, you know, many feet long, with those tentacles out the front. Anyway, sort of back in the ancient seas, you had animals which were cephalopods but more mobile, still with a shell. Then at some stage, for reasons that are, again, not really understood, the shell was abandoned. And you began to have a subset of these animals beginning to live a life in which they've still got a basic mollusk body plan, but they have no protective shell. In some cases, as we see with cuttlefish and squid, they have some hard parts still inside the body, but no protective shell on the outside. And in the case of octopuses, there's no shell left at all. So those animals simultaneously acquired many more possibilities for behavior. Like you could do a lot more if you're not constrained by the shell. But also, of course, they were extremely vulnerable without the shell. So they had to face a new kind of danger from the fish evolving around them with spines and sharp teeth and good eyes. So although many of the steps here are very much conjectural, a plausible picture has it that, you know, it was the loss of the shell that sent the octopus down this very unusual road where it began to evolve a large complex nervous system, perhaps partly just as a way of controlling this very unusual body with all of its possibilities, and partly because they had to be fairly on the ball or they would not last very long.
In what ways does our understanding of the octopus give insight into the nature of consciousness? What do we learn?
It's not that I think that the octopus itself specifically holds the key to understanding the nature of consciousness. I do think, though, that thinking about other minds, thinking about the origins of nervous systems, of complex behavior, the origins of complex sensing, the origins of learning by tracking the good and bad consequences of your actions, all of those sorts of things are important components in understanding what it was about some living things that gave rise to consciousness. So the way I think about it is, you know, we need to understand the whole evolutionary picture. And within that evolutionary picture, octopuses occupy this very special, unusual place because they are so far from us and yet they have such large nervous systems. So I think that although at this stage, people like me are just sort of probing at the question, what are the most basic kinds of subjective experience? When did they arise? Why did they arise? In which animals is it present and in which animals is it absent? Should we think of this as a kind of entirely a distinction of degree where in some animals there's a kind of richer or, you know, brighter, more intense kind of subjectivity, whereas in others it sort of fades out and eventually gets to nothing? All of those questions are very much up in the air. And I think that by thinking about particular cases, we can start to sort of put pieces into place. And that's the motivation for the philosophical perspective on cephalopods in particular.
In your book, you talk about the cuttlefish and all of its color changes. Would you speak a bit about those and their significance?
Sure, yes. I mean, cephalopods in general can change color. In at least a great many cases, they can change the color of their skin rapidly. Octopuses are very good at it. They are specialists in camouflage. Cuttlefish are more colorful. They are spectacularly colorful. And here I have in mind especially a couple of species. And the Australian one is the giant cuttlefish, the largest of the cuttlefish species. So this animal can be 2 feet to 3 feet long. It's not a small animal at all. In picturing it, you should sort of picture a back end, almost like a elongated turtle-like shape, but with no shell on the outside. And on the front, a kind of octopus-like cluster of arms. So it's a bit like a squid in a lot of ways, and squid are their closest relatives. And that skin, especially the surface of the arms and the back there, the sort of the backside and the front, can change color in the most extraordinary way. They can change their entire body color and patterning in less than a second. It's not just uniform colors, but patterns, stripes and spots and somewhat more complex shapes that can come and go. They can play sort of dynamic or movie-like patterns on their skin. There's a particular pattern called the passing cloud where you have waves of darkness that sort of pass either forwards or backwards along the animal. I guess probably a wave takes maybe 2 seconds or so to go from the front to the back of the animal or vice versa. And they can produce just about any color you can imagine, especially reds and oranges, whites, surprisingly good at green. Surprisingly, because to produce red and yellow and orange, they use one kind of mechanism, which are these sacks of pigment, like little sacks of paint, which are in their skin, which they expand. To produce greens and blues is a bit harder because they have to use another layer of cells that have little tiny mirrors that reflect and refract the light. So they have to use different sorts of mechanisms to produce different kinds of colors, but the colors they can produce are almost unlimited.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope it will contribute to what is now becoming, I think, productive and progressive body of work trying to understand the minds of non-human animals in a way that inevitably involves some speculation, but that is responsive to data and responsive to the biology. So I think just trying to understand the animals is part of it. In the last chapter, I tried to make the case for a larger theme as well. I do think that when we think about the sea and marine life, there's an importance the sea has in the history of animal life and the history of nervous systems, the history of our minds, that's not always appreciated. So, you know, life itself began in water, perhaps not in the sea, quite possibly though it was in the sea, but in a watery environment of some sort, very likely. Early animals all were marine animals. It was quite a while before any animals made it up onto land. So you should think of the early evolution of animals and the evolution of the first minds as taking place in a marine environment. And I think that that's reflected in the chemistry that we all have. So we all carry around a huge amount of salt water, which is essentially a kind of continuation of the environment of the sea, the environment in which early life and early animals lived. And when I look at the sea and think about the sea now, I do think of it as the place where these things all started. And when we reflect on the need to protect the sea from overfishing, chemical pollution, all the things that are being done to it, I think some contribution can be made from thinking about that kind of creative role, the cradle-like role that the sea had in the evolution of animals.
Thanks so much for being here. You were just listening to Peter Godfrey Smith, author of the book Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness, published in 2016 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Power at 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.